Let's turn to Luke 21. Luke 21. Now, if you remember the context, this is a few days before Jesus will be crucified. He's in Jerusalem. He's had the triumphal entry. He's cleaned house in the temple. The religious leaders have come to him and started challenging him. Where'd you get your authority? And then they want to try to trip him up, hopefully get him to say something against Rome so that they can have him arrested and put to death. So they send various men to him to pretend that they are righteous men that are asking him questions, and Jesus obviously answers all their questions in ways that put them to shame. And then he asked them a question about the Messiah, and they didn't know an answer to it. And then at the end of chapter 20, verse 45, it says, "Then in the audience of all the people," and you have to understand that there are thousands of people crowded around him now. The Jerusalem is packed, tensions are high. And it says, "He said in the audience of all the people, he said unto his disciples, beware of the scribes." Now, the scribes, Pharisees, religious leaders, that's the group. They're all around him. They've been the one asking him questions. And then he turns to his followers with them all in attendance and says, "Watch out for these guys." Imagine that. I mean, don't be like these guys. They're a bunch of losers. I mean, that's kind of what he says. He says, "Beware of the scribes which desire to walk in long robes, and they love greetings in the markets, in the highest seats in the synagogues, in the chief room in the feasts, which devour widows' houses, and for a show make long prayers. The same shall receive greater damnation." They're all about the look. They like the long robe, greetings in the markets. They like the religious garb because it makes them stand out and look holy. Those of you who know Adam Kasperzak, that Suze's husband, he and I have this running, we like to poke fun at each other. And so we're always calling each other Your Holiness, Your Grace, the Reverend, you know. And he comes from a Catholic background, which is harder for him. And so we like to harass each other. And I actually, a lot of you saw it on Facebook. It's been one of the most widely viewed things that I put up online. I was at a wedding a couple weeks ago, and he was there, and he had on this black, sport coat, and he had on a tan shirt, no collar, just sort of a circular collar around it with a white T-shirt under there, and the T-shirt stuck up about a quarter of an inch, so he's got a tan shirt on and then a little white thing, and I said, "You know, that looks a little bit like a backward collar, you know, that a priest would wear." "Oh, yeah, be quiet." So I pull out my phone, and I took a picture of him, and then with the intention of harassing him with it, and I tried to do something with it. I really couldn't. So finally, it had been a week, and I sent the picture to Al the other day, and I said, "Could you do something for me? 15 minutes later, he's got photoshopped in a priest shirt and collar, you know, the white collar and the black shirt in there, set inside. And it, I mean, those of you who saw it, so many people were asking me, "Did he really wear that to the wedding?" And I put that up online, you know, and everybody was just, "Bah, ha, ha," you know. Because we like to tease each other, because neither one of us, we both think it's a joke that God would have anything to do with us at all, let alone put us in a place where we're a pastor of a church. So to take on a religious title like you're someone to revere, or you're the most holy or the most reverend, it's laughable. These people love that. They love the attention. They love the idea of people greeting them and them having attained a position of holiness and righteousness. And on one hand, they were ripping off widows, and yet at the same time, they would make these long flowery prayers that everyone would hear and see how holy they were. And Jesus' point is, don't be like these guys, because they're not fooling anybody. Or they may be fooling some people around them, but they're not fooling me. They'll receive the greater condemnation. And it's in that context that comes right into this. Now, he's in the temple. In Luke 21, it says, "He looked up, and he saw the rich men casting their gifts into the treasury. And he also saw a certain poor widow casting in thither two mites. And he said, of a truth, I say unto you, that this poor widow has cast in more than they all. For all these have of their abundance cast in unto the offering of God, but she of her penury hath cast in all the living that she had." In the outer courts of the temple, there were around the outside of edge, I believe, 13 collection boxes. They called them trumpets because over them they would have like a big funnel kind of thing. And people could make various offerings. I think, from what I read, they were actually divided out by purpose. This one was for the wood for the temple. This one was for salt for the steps. This one was for this. And they had some of the daily needs spread out, and people would come in and put offerings in there. Some people, and Jesus had said in another place, you know, when you give, don't be like the hypocrites who make a big show of the giving so everyone would look. And some people made a big deal about coming in and, bah, 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 bah. You know, I don't know if they were actually blowing trumpets, but they were certainly drawing attention to themselves, and everyone would say, oh, that's fantastic. Well, Jesus is there, and he sees this widow come in. A widow, and this is not a well-off widow. This is a poor widow. There's no Social Security. She's dirt poor. That's what it talks about, her penury, her poverty. And she throws in two mites. Two mites were about as low as you could get coinage. One of the commentators that I read factored it out to be about 1% of a day's wage, which if you do the math, if you figure $7.50 an hour today, 8 hours a day, 1%, it's about 60 cents. So she comes in and she's got, you know, two bit. She's got a couple quarters. She chucks that in the offering. She's obviously not making a big deal about it. And yet Jesus is making a big deal about it. In fact, he turns to the people who are with him and is like, You see that? Did you see that right there? I'll tell you what, that woman has just given more than anybody. And she gave monetarily next to nothing. For Jesus to say that, it tends to speak to me that it has nothing to do with the quantity of what you give. It has more to do with what it costs you. Now, you know, we're probably a little overly weird about money here on the false side or on the low side, because I feel like there's so many abuses on the other side of it where you're being shaken down for money that I want to go to the opposite extreme. When it comes to giving to the Lord, it's something that we should do because it is good for us, not because he needs anything that you have. Everything is his. Anything you have is because he gave it to you anyways. For those of you who had a trip put on you before about what you should give and how much you should give and all of that, 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 2, Paul is writing to one of the churches, and they're going to be taking up an offering for some of the other poor churches, and he said, on the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store as God has prospered him, so that there be no gatherings when I come. He's like, how about this? You guys, on the first day of the week, whatever God has prospered you with, take some portion of that and lay it up so that we can just take that and give it to him. I don't want to be doing special offerings. I don't want to be doing fundraisers. And he said, do it as God has prospered you. If God hasn't prospered you, he's not expecting you to lay anything up. It says in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, in the context of giving, he says, if there first be a willing mind, if you feel motivated to give because of what the Lord has done for you, then give. And he says, it's accepted according to that a man has and not according to what he has not. He's not expecting you to give beyond what you can give. He knows what he's allowed you to have for resources. The scripture says he allows some people to have wealth and other people he does not. And there's no great trip about how much. But we should give. We should give to him as a natural response, as part of worship. And what this woman did, you have to look at what she gave. She didn't give monetarily a whole lot, but it cost her everything. Everything. You know, all of these other guys that were coming in, they were giving out of excess. Okay, I've paid all my bills, I've done all my things, what do I have left? Okay, well, I can give a certain part of that, and that was what they were giving in. Monetarily, it was a huge amount, but for them personally, it wasn't. You know, David in 2 Samuel chapter 24, he makes a stupid mistake and he starts to trust in himself instead of God. He does a census to see how many soldiers he has against the counsel of everybody. David, you don't want to do this because God is our strength. You know, who cares how many people we have? That doesn't mean anything. You beat a giant with a sling as a little boy. Why number the people? But David was in a stupid place and he did it, and a plague starts out. And punishment for that and some other things the Israelites were doing. And then finally, as it's going through, they come to the threshing floor of Araunah, and they realize he's supposed to make a sacrifice there to make it stop. And the guy, Ornan in one place, Araunah in another place, he owns this. He's got a threshing floor. He's got oxen there and everything. And he sees what's going on. He sees there's actually an angel involved. He sees it supernaturally, and it freaks him out. And he's like, David, here's all the stuff. You can have the land. You can have the oxen. You can take all of the tools there. Cut them up for wood. Let's do this thing right now. Just take it. And David says an interesting thing to him. He says, no, I'm going to buy it from you because I'm not going to offer anything to God that costs me nothing. If it doesn't cost me something, if there's not pain involved, pain not because I have to hurt myself, but pain in that I'm offering something that requires me to trust him. That's what it is. Am I trusting God? It's funny, we sing songs, and look at the songs we sang this morning. When I survey the wondrous cross. What's the one verse? Were the whole realm of nature mine, 'twould be an offering far too small. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my life, my soul, my $5. My all. The problem is we've been in, many of us who've grown up and gone to other churches, we've been in a church, and the plate has come by, and you've had that thought go through your mind, oh, I hope I have something other than a 20 with me. I should have made change. What was I thinking? Because I don't want it to pass by and not put anything in because everyone else will think I'm a cheapskate. But I can't give all because, I need that. So what do I do? And it's sad because on the other side of things, you have to understand there's a whole industry that is raised up around extracting money out of people. I mean, they've done studies on the best way to get money out of congregations. Even when it comes to the offering plates, when you buy the offering plates, there's two types of offering plates. If you buy the silver and the gold offering plates, you can buy them with the felt pad on the bottom or without the felt pad on the bottom. And you actually make more money if you buy the ones without the felt pad. Because when there's a metal bottom on it, nobody wants to drop a quarter in there and go clink. So they'll reach for a bill when it comes by and they feel like they're being shook down so that nobody realizes how cheap they are. Isn't that sad? That's why we don't do that, because I never want anybody to feel like they're compelled to give out of some care for what other people think. This woman was not compelled about what anyone was going to think, because anyone who saw her throw in what she threw in would think that was nothing, except for God, who said that's everything. And I know that she is going to be in a place, because of the way that she gave out of her need in trust to the Lord, she's going to be more highly rewarded than those who are dropping in thousands. Now we come to verse 5. And it says, as some spoke of the temple, how greatly adorned with goodly stones and gifts, he said, as for these things which you behold, the days will come in which there shall not be left one stone upon another, which shall not be thrown down. They're in the temple. The temple was, they called it Herod's temple. He didn't build it, but he improved it around 19 BC. Herod the Great was a little guy, under 5 feet tall. And he was ruler in that area, and he had a little man complex of feeling like he had to do big things to compensate for being short and wanted to make a name for himself. And so he decided he was going to do architectural works that would live forever and bring him a name of glory. He decided he wanted to do something that outstripped the pyramids. Now, we've seen pictures of the pyramids, the Great Pyramid of Giza, right? And these other pyramids. And you know how there are all of these series of stones that are laid up in a pyramid. Well, did you know it didn't actually look like that when it was built? It actually was covered in white stones that set on top of all of those little shelves. So the whole thing was white. I don't know if it was marble or not, but it was actually, and I believe there was a gold cap at the top and the whole thing. I mean, it was quite a structure. It's structured now. It's been how many thousand years and the thing is still there. He decided that this temple was going to be more impressive than that. So he undertook this process, and it took like 40 years to build this temple or to rebuild this temple. And it was a sight to behold. It was said by, you know, some of the people who lived in that day, if you haven't seen the temple in Jerusalem, you've never seen a building. You don't know what a building is. It had these pillars outside that were 40 feet high that were made out of marble, white marble, all one piece. One piece, 40 feet high, these huge pillars carved out of one solid piece brought there. The stones on this temple were immense. Some of the foundation stones, I think the biggest one, something like 45 feet by 11 feet by 16 feet, weighs somewhere between 550, 675 tons. And all of these foundation stones of various sizes were brought together. They were all carved and fashioned in the quarry, and they were brought so that they fit together with no mortar. I mean, I've been adding on to my house, okay? I got a compound miter saw with a laser sight on it. Okay, and I'm cutting stuff multiple times using a slide rule to get it to fit because, you know, you trim something out and then you bring it over there and you think that's just not quite long enough. I wonder what I did wrong there. I better go back and trim it again. These guys quarried everything and shaped everything away from the temple because they didn't want the sound. And this was something that was told to Solomon when he built the first temple. I want all the work done in the quarry because I don't want the sound of any work happening where my house is. So they did it all away and brought it and just laid it all together. And these things, even though they were hundreds of tons, some of these stones, they fit together so well they didn't have to use any mortar at all. They were just flush. And even today, the retaining walls and some of that are still around, and you still can't barely get a knife blade between them a couple thousand years later. So you have this thing, it was overlaid with marble, there was gold all over the top and the spires, the door, huge doors on these things. On the front of the door they had the vine, this huge vine that represented Israel that was made out of solid gold. The clusters of grapes on this vine were the size of a man made out of solid gold. This was the most impressive building you can imagine. And so they're there looking at this huge, awesome thing, and they're saying, Jesus, check out this temple. Isn't this something? And a couple days before his death, he says, well, I'm going to tell you the truth. The days are going to come when not one of these stones is going to be left on top of another one. Now, on some level, it's even a mystery to us how they could get a 500-ton, 600-ton stone brought into place and laid into place with no fork truck, with no crane, with no bulldozer, with no skidder, with no dump truck, none of that. It was all done by animal and human labor. And for Jesus to say, you don't understand, this place is going to be demolished to the point where not even a stone will, in the days before gunpowder, okay, there's no bombs, there's nothing like that. How could that possibly be? They figured it had to be the end of the world, nothing else would make sense. But see, what Jesus saw was that 70 AD, which was about 40 years after he says this thing, Titus Vespasian is going to come in because the Jews have rebelled, and he's going to lay siege to Jerusalem, and he's going to set up his troops all around it, and they're going to blockade the city, which means there's no way for food or supplies to get in or out, and the people in the city start to starve to death. When it was all said and done, over 1 million of them did. It got so bad that they were eating their children. And they were throwing the dead babies over the side and the dead adults over the side of the walls. There was no way to bury anybody. There was disease running rampant. They were fighting. It was horrible. And Titus had given very strict instructions. Do not destroy that temple. In fact, he told the Jews, look, if you will just surrender, we won't wipe out the temple. We will let you keep worshiping. You just have to submit. And they refused to do it. And finally, some soldiers broke through. They got inside, and one of them took and threw a torch in through the window to the temple. The inside of the temple was cedar overlaid with gold. We use cedar today, don't we? Kindling wood. I have a bunch of it at my house. Burns great. And the fire burned so hot inside of that thing that all the gold that was on the outside and on the top melted. And because there was no mortar between any of those stones, all the gold ran down in between those stones and then solidified when it cooled down. The Roman soldiers, part of their pay were the spoils of war. Whatever they could take for booty, they could take. And so they got together and they would get hundreds of them on pry bars and they would pull those stones apart one at a time and scrape all of the gold off. So every single one of those stones was thrown down exactly like Jesus said. Now, what you have to understand as we go through this, and I am not going to, you know, When we went through Matthew 24, we took a long time going through this chapter with a similar account of the same thing. We're not going to do that. But one thing that you have to take from this is if Jesus can see that clearly 40 years into the future, he can see that clearly 2,000 years into the future, he can see clearly into 40 years of your future and my future. So he knows what he's talking about. In fact, in Isaiah 46, one of the hallmarks of God is this. He says in Isaiah 46, 9, remember the former things of old, for I am God, there's none else. I am God, there's none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from the ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying my counsel shall stand, I'll do all my pleasure. God knows that he's outside of time. That's how you know he's God. And he makes these challenges to all these other fake gods, saying, you say you're God, okay, tell me what's going to happen before it happens, and I'll believe you. He says, as for me, well, this is going to be this guy Cyrus. And he calls him by name 100 years before he's born. And he says, he's going to come in and he's going to defeat Babylon. And he tells how he's going to get in. The gates are going to be left open. And I mean, everything that God says happens exactly like he says happens. So Jesus is telling us what it's going to be like in the last days. They ask him in verse 7, Master, when shall these things be? And what sign will there be when these things shall come to pass? And if you read Matthew 24 account, they also say, and what'll be, you know, the end of the world, because they thought that was part of it. And it's interesting to me because there's a parallel account in Matthew, Mark, and Luke of this setting. Luke gives us slightly different information as parts of it he leaves out. I think Luke is writing mainly to the Gentiles, which is why he leaves some of the more Jewish stuff out. But all three of them start with this. And he said, take heed that you be not deceived. The first thing you need to know right up front, when you start looking at what's to come and how's it going to be, he says, well, be careful that nobody deceives you. He says, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and that the time draws near, go ye not therefore after them. Now, does that mean many shall come and say that I am the Christ in my name, as in saying that I am the Christ? Or is it saying that many people will come claiming to represent me? Saying, and I think, yes, both of those things. Paul tells Timothy in 2 Timothy in chapter 3, the beginning of that chapter, he says, know also that in the last days perilous times will come. And then after he lists some of the characteristics of humanity in those days, he said, evil men and seducers will wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. But you continue in the things which you've learned and you've been assured of, knowing who you've learned. People are going to come and they're going to be saying all kinds of garbage, but just ignore them. And you continue in what you know is true. We know this is true. The word of God is true. There are all kinds of people making all kinds of predictions about when the Christ is coming. In fact, in case you didn't know it, what's today, March 6th? April, May. You've got about 75 days until Jesus returns. According to Harold Camping, Judgment Day will be May 21st, 2011. Of course, that's when Jesus will return and take the church out. The actual end of the universe doesn't happen until October 21st. And he knows exactly that's a date because May 21st, 2011, he says, is exactly 7,000 years after 4,990 BC when the flood began. And he's figured that out by studying Scripture. Of course, the guy writing the article I'm reading says, yeah, but what about September 1994? Because that's what he said in the 1980s was going to be the day. He knew for sure, and then it was going to be September 1994, but apparently he was wrong then. But now he's really right, so you better sell all you have and, you know. And then he starts to talk about wars. How many of you guys watch the news? You guys watch the news? Do you read the newspaper? Anybody get the newspaper? I mean, not the Lincoln newspaper, that, you know. I'm saying news. I don't care about whose cat had kittens. I'm talking news, you know, world events. Not pet of the week in the pound. You laugh. We get the newspaper, my daughter. Can I have it first? And where does she go? She goes to the Humane Society to see what the pet of the week is. Okay, all done. And hands her back to me. That's all she cares about. Truthfully, it's probably the most useful thing on the news these days. He says, when you shall hear of wars and commotions, be not terrified, for these things must first come to pass, but the end is not by and by. You know, in discussing this in Matthew 24, one of the things that Jesus says when he starts to talk about the last days and the wars, and of course we all have concerns, we've seen all of the movies, 2012, and we've seen all of the Armageddon and when the comet comes and smashes the planet and all of those ones. And one of the things Jesus said, speaking of war in Matthew 24, is except those days should be shortened, there should be no flesh saved. In other words, if I don't step in and interrupt, humanity would get wiped out. Now, just that one statement. You hear Jesus make a statement like that. Somebody didn't pay the oil bill, apparently. I don't think we need heat right now. Got to leave a nice pause so Mike can edit that out of the tape before it goes on the radio. You know, it's funny, speaking of on the radio, these shows, you know, they take the teachings that we do here and they edit them and they put them on the radio. And Mike Archer does the editing. And he's got to take whatever length we go here and he's got to cut it down to fit in like 19 or 20 minutes. Get the intro, we get the extra. And when I was going through Matthew, Josh was in his car one day, and it was not that long ago they were broadcasting the Matthew ones. And I'm going through this section, right? And I happen to be talking about electromagnetic pulse, which I'll mention in a second, and what it would happen if one of those goes off. And the way he had edited the show, I'm talking about wars, rumblings of wars, and I basically said something like, and 2/3 of the population of the United States would die. Boo, boo, boo. You've been listening to Hearing by the Word. We hope you've been encouraged by today's broadcast. I mean, that's where he cut it right there. So I don't want to leave it, you know, where you're thinking, oh my gosh, that's why we're going through the whole thing. Because he says don't be terrified. But we do have to understand what days we live in. I was reading an interesting article in doing research, and it was talking about how close we came to World War III. In 2007. Did you know that? We were inches away from World War III in 2007. Because what happened was Syria was building a nuclear reactor secretly out in the desert. Secretly, except for Israel knew about it. And it was the type of Israel, the nuclear reactor that North Korea has, because they were getting some of their materials from North Korea, with the idea that the waste from this nuclear reactor could produce the plutonium necessary to make nuclear weapons. Israel knows a few things, and one of them is if Syria has nuclear weapons, we're toast, because they want them for one reason, and that's to shoot them at us. We know that. So they decided that can't happen. So they sent a group of jets in there to go in and bomb it into non-existence. The thing is, the only one who knew about it were them and a few people in the United States who weren't talking about it. So all of a sudden, these jets start flying into Syria. Were they going to Iran? Who knows? Russia knows because they have satellites and they can see what's going on. And of course, all of these groups have ties with each other, and some of them have pledged mutual assurances to one another. And basically the article, and it was from the British perspective, of they didn't know what was going on. And so everyone is on heightened alert because they don't know what Israel is going to bomb. Now, they bombed this nuclear reactor. Of course, the Syrians denied there was ever a reactor like that, and they cried foul about, oh, they just come in and wiped out a bunch of warehouses in the desert. And then Israel said, really? Huh. And they, you know, produced whatever was necessary to show that it was a nuclear site that they wiped out. But it is that close. I mean, you're reading the news. You see what's going on in Egypt. You see what's going on in Libya. And they're, you know, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Iran. And the thing is, with many of these places, you know, we look at that, and if we just read the newspapers that we get here, they say, oh, these people are rallying for freedom. They just want a democracy like we have in America. You have to understand, if you watch any of those, all of their freedom rallies contain the phrase, death to America! The people who want to take over are not going to make it better. It's like what happened in the 70s with Iran. Oh, the Shah, he's a bad guy. We got to get him out. Has it been better since the Ayatollahs and Ahmadinejad are in? And for Jesus to say, if I don't shorten those last days when the wars start, no flesh will be saved, how does that really play out? What do you think that meant to these guys? What do you mean no flesh would be saved? I mean, you think about the wars in our past. Civil War. Revolutionary War. Civil War. World War I, okay? World War II. There was no way in World War II that there was a possibility that every human on the planet was going to die. It wasn't technologically possible. It certainly wasn't in the Civil War. It's not like with muskets, you know, we're gonna wipe out the planet. It's not going to happen. But then in World War II, at the end, we developed the nuclear bomb. I was discussing it with Alan yesterday at the men's breakfast, and you know, when they tested the first one of those things, they were about 90% sure that if they set one off, the reaction would stop. But there was about a 10% chance in their mind, having done all of the calculations, that if they detonated a nuclear explosion, it would spread to all of the elements on the planet and the entire planet would blow up. They weren't sure. But they still pushed that button anyway. I mean, does that bother you at all? There's a 10% chance that we'll all die. Well, let's just see, you know. It's like a bunch of guys drinking in the sand pit saying, hey, watch this, you know. Bad things happen when that happens. And it caused Albert Einstein to say, clearly we've passed the point where our technology has exceeded our morality. Well, now, to hear Jesus say, if those days aren't shortened, all flesh could perish, we think nothing of it because we've grown up in an era when that's a possibility. We have our nuclear arsenal is measured in Earth arsenals. How many times over? It's like 3 or 4 that we could destroy every square inch of the planet. Russia has a 3 Earth arsenal. We have a 4 Earth arsenal. It could happen. And in the 80s, when I was, you know, growing up and everything, you had the Cold War. And there was some, I mean, it was tense times, don't get me wrong. But when you think about who our enemy was in the 80s, it was those godless Russians, right? The atheists, that's what they were. They were an atheist society. They didn't believe in God. The good thing about a society that doesn't believe in God, they have absolutely no desire to die because that's it. This life is all there is. So the idea of mutually assured destruction, it works with them because they don't want to die. And then, you know, then you got Korea now has nukes and they're atheistic. But you got to mix in the fact you've got a senile crazy dude whose population is starving and he's going to die soon. So he's got a whole lot less to lose. And one of the reports that I was reading the other day said in the 90s they had the ability to deliver a nuclear weapon on a missile over the United States. They could do it then. And now you have like the Iranians and stuff. When you've, those guys are a different story altogether because for them, to live is Allah, and to die, killing you, is your only guaranteed ticket into paradise. That's if I die killing you, I got 70 ladies waiting for me. How do you play chicken with that person? When they think to hit you, they win. It's a different ball game. And you think, yeah, but they what do they got at most? One nuclear bomb? Well, and I mentioned it before, the idea of the EMP. I actually found some new information, which I didn't know, the electromagnetic pulse. One of the side effects of those nuclear tests that we did back in the 50s and the 60s, we found out, is, you know, a nuclear bomb going off on the ground does bad things. Big explosion, kills a lot of people. The radiation kills a lot of people. But we tried all kinds of different tests. Let's see what happens if we set it off underwater. Let's set one off under the ground. Let's set one off up in the air. Well, what they found is when you set one of those babies off high enough up in the air, outside of the atmosphere, there's this huge explosion, of course, but that doesn't hurt anybody when it's way up in space, right? That's what Superman always does. When the bomb's going to go off, he flies it up into space, goes off, nobody's hurt by it. But it also creates gamma rays. X-rays, you know what an X-ray is. You go in for that. It's thousands of volts that are flashed for a second, and it lights up your insides, right? Well, gamma waves are X-rays that are at, like, millions in volts, you know, just a lot more current. When you set off a detonation, all of these gamma rays come down towards the planet. And as they go through the atmosphere, they run into, like, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, all these elements. And there's so much force on these things that they start blowing off electrons. So you get all of these electrons in a big wave, and it's really a microwave pulse. And because it's concentrated and you get this big microwave coming down, it doesn't hurt you and I. You wouldn't even know it. But electronic equipment is extremely sensitive to it, to the point where it will fry everything that's electronic that hasn't been specifically shielded permanently. Anything that has a computer chip in it, gone like that. And what they found is you don't have to have a huge bomb. I mean, we've made some big bombs. big megaton, which is like millions of tons of TNT. 50, we've got some 50 megaton ones, which are unbelievably. Russia, who likes to make everything bigger, they have like 100 megaton bomb, but they can't even set one of those off without killing whoever pulls the trigger. They can't drop it from a plane because you can't get away fast enough. I mean, it's that big. But you don't need that. A small one done at the right spot over an altitude will send this pulse out that just shuts down all the electronics. Well, what's the big deal with that? Any of you guys go through the ice storm back in 98? You remember that? I did. I didn't have power for 3-4 days. You know it takes 5 gallons of water to flush a toilet? I know that because I was carrying it from the stream. You ever try to melt 5 gallons worth of snow into 5 gallons of water? It takes, you can't do it, okay? And when your power's out, your well pump doesn't work here. So where are you going to get your water? And everything in the refrigerator rots. What do you do for food? Well, I'll just go to the grocery store. Really? What are you going to pay with? Well, I'll just use my debit. Oh, that's right. None of those work. I'll just drive. Oh, you mean my car's fried too? Yeah, it is. And the bank can't give me any money? Nope. ATM, everything's down. They don't know what anybody has. My mortgage payment won't show up. Well, you're right. It won't. But food won't show up either. You won't be able to get water. And now you'll have no heat. And for us here, and when I think about it, living where we live, in the town that we live, we probably do okay. I don't expect it would be chaos. I mean, there would be some hard stuff happening, you know. And I understand the hard stuff. I have a daughter who requires certain medication on a regular basis and fed in a very specific way. And I know what would happen if we had this long period of time. But you read some of these reports. The thing that really freaked me out that I found out that I didn't realize, I mean, we know that you can get one of those EMPs from a nuke going off. And we know that North Korea already has a technology to launch a missile, what they have right now, to do it if they wanted to. Iran, you don't even have to have a long-range missile because all you have to do is get a freighter off the coast of the United States and put one of their Sahab-3 missiles on there, and you could drop a nuclear weapon on the top of that, not a big one, and you could get it. And if you did it in the air over, say, Chicago, you could take out the whole eastern seaboard, all the power, all the lights, all the electronics gone permanently. You want to live in New York City when there's no lights, no power, no police, no radio, no telephone? It's not a happy thing, but if it happened here, I think we'd be okay. But what I found out I didn't know is there's another source of EMP. Did you know that? Solar flares do it too. This is from the Federal Energy Regulation Commission's report of 2010. In 1989, an unexpected geomagnetic storm triggered an event on the Hydro-Quebec power system that resulted in its complete collapse within 92 seconds, leaving 6 million customers without power. The same storm triggered hundreds of incidents across the United States, including destroying a major transformer at an East Coast nuclear generating station. Major geomagnetic storms, such as those that occurred in 1859 and 1921, are rare, which is good, and they occur approximately every 100 years. Storms of this type are global events that can last for days and will likely have an effect on electrical networks worldwide. Should a storm of this magnitude strike today, it would interrupt power to as many as 130 million people in the United States alone, requiring several years to recover. Does that sound happy to you? I mean, that doesn't sound happy to me. And the sun does it, and it happens cyclically. The thing is, it's happened all through history, but who cares? Because in 1859, what got fried? Nobody's cell phones stopped working because they didn't have them. A few telegraph, that was the biggest one on record in 18. It was the Carrington event or something like that, and it wiped out telegraph lines. Oh, no, not the telegraph. You know, big deal. Today, it would have a much different effect. And yet, I found this article, which blows me away, from a conference in which at the Tools for Change conference in New York City, both novelist Margaret Atwood and Sideways founder Charles Stack worried about an apocalyptic problem for the digital publishing industry. An EMP could cripple all of our electronic devices in a few seconds. Could your e-book library and electronic writing survive this kind of disaster? Never mind food. What about my Kindle? Twilight could be gone. I might not even have what I need. You're thinking, do these people have a clue? That's not your biggest problem. I mean, I can read this stuff and I could get, you know, we could be attacked at any moment and there's people who want to kill me. And, of course, we've already found that the Iranians have been practicing launching missiles from container ships in the Caspian Sea and practicing mid-air detonations. But I'm sure it's part of just routine training. I mean, what could they possibly want to do with that? The fact that they call us the Great Satan and they want to wipe us off the map. Yet Jesus says, when you hear all of this stuff, don't be terrified. Because these things have to happen. But the end isn't by and by. You know, in preparing for this, I was listening to some vintage Joe Foch from 1998. You remember Y2K? I was a little over the top, not quite as over the top as some people, but I was pretty close. You know, we all had our stores and freezers and all of that stuff of things to come. And I was listening to him in 98 when he was talking about that problem in context of this and, you know, all of the stuff that they were doing. And they had a board of people put together who were involved in different industries to try to find out how it was going to impact them and all of that. And he talked about calling Chuck Smith, who is Calvary Chapel founder in California, huge church, Costa Mesa, and said, Chuck, have you heard about this Y2K thing? What are you going to do? And Chuck says, well, I've been memorizing Psalm 46. This is Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore will we not fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof, Selah. There's a river, the streams whereof shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. God's in the midst of her, and she shall not be moved. God shall help her that right early. The heathen raged, the kingdoms were moved, he uttered his voice, the earth melted, the Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge, Selah. Come the end of the earth, he breaketh the bow, he cuts the spear in sunder, he burns the chariot into fire. But be still, and know that I'm God. I will be exalted among the heathen, I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us, the God of Jacob is our refuge. I mean, is it wise to do things, basic preparedness, so that if the power goes out, we live in Maine, the power goes out all the time. Of course it's wise to have a little food on hand and some other stuff. Does that mean you need to set up the sandbags and mount the 50 cal at the door to blow away your neighbors? Of course not. It's to be a help. And he said, you know, nation is going to rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There'll be these confederacies. You'll see that happen. And these will be signs as the end approaches. And we see it starting today. Great earthquakes will be in diverse places, and famines and pestilences and fearful sights and great signs shall be from heaven. That's the way it's going to be. And the Bible describes these things as birth pangs. I remember going through labor and delivery with my wife. You get in there and they strap on the baby seismic thing, you know, where they put on her stomach that measures the contractions. And when they first start happening, you're at home and they have those Braxton Hicks. Who were Braxton and Hicks? I don't know who they were, but apparently they're the first ones who ever really named that little, ooh. You know, you remember that? It happened, and she goes, ooh. And you're like, what was that? I don't know. It just sort of tightened up. Ooh, it was a Braxton Hicks contraction, you know. Okay, well, we better get what to expect when we're expecting and schedule our Lamaze class and all of that. At the end, there wasn't a, ooh. It was a, ah! You know, you did this to me! I mean, it was that. And it increases in intensity. They've got that monitor on you, and you see, and at first it's just like a little, you know, and then when they finally start coming in, like, big time, it looks like, you know, earthquake, seismograph thing, the room is shaking, and I could see them coming because they start registering on that meter before she could feel them, and I would kind of tense up, but she'd be like, no, you know, and it would, boom, the big one. And that's how this is. It is increasing in frequency and intensity. When it first starts, they don't have you do anything. Well, how long has it been since the last one? I don't know, a week? Don't call me again. Just go back. Well, it's been about, they've been about 10 minutes apart, and, you know, water's broken. Okay, now we know things are happening, time to get in here. And they increase in frequency and intensity, and that's what we see, these things happening. Are there pestilences today? Duh. Bird flu, swine flu, AIDS, all of these things are happening, these horrible diseases. Is there wars forming? Yes. Do we see tsunamis and earthquakes and all that? Seems to be a lot of those, too. He says, but before all of these, you got something to look forward to before that. They're going to lay hands on you, and they're going to persecute you. And they're going to deliver you up to synagogues and into prisons to be brought before kings and rulers for mine's sake, my name's sake, and it shall turn to you for a testimony. And they're probably going to say, why aren't you freaking out when all this is happening? I mean, times are bad. You follow this Jesus. What's the deal? And this is what he says, settle it therefore in your heart not to meditate before what you shall answer. For I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all of your adversaries shall not be able to gainsay or resist. Don't sweat what you're going to say. And from a person who likes to know what he's going to say and write out his notes in advance or at least have it very well developed in his mind, this is hard for me to just wing it. But yet, he says, you know, you're going to be called to account for me. You're going to be brought up in front of people to give a testimony. And when that happens, I will make sure you know what you need to know so that you can say what needs to be said, because I think he wants to win them too. He says, and you shall be, this isn't good news, by the way, you shall be betrayed both by parents and brethren and kinsfolk and friends, and some of you shall they cause to be put to death. That's the cost for some of you. And we're going to put this on a t-shirt, I think, to sell in the lobby. Next, verse 17, and you shall be hated of all men for my name's sake. Welcome to Lincoln Christian Fellowship. You'll be hated of all men. Come here. But Jesus said that. If you identify with me, understand what I say and what I teach is at enmity with the world, and that it is opposite. They say, look out for number one. I say, deny yourself. They say, step on whoever you have to get to the top. I say, love your enemies, turn the other cheek. And everything I teach you. They say, you got to be rich. I say, sell all you have, give it to the poor, follow me, and you'll have treasures in heaven. Everything that he says is the opposite of what the world says. People don't like that. He says, but there shall not a hair of your head perish. Now, wait a minute. You just told me in verse 16 you're going to kill some of us, and then in 18 you won't have a head of my hair perish? How could that possibly be? Well, because apparently dying physically is not perishing, right? John 3:16, you know it. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. Dying physically is not the worst thing that will ever happen to you. In fact, it's going to happen to you. Last time I checked, everybody did. But there is a second death or eternal life. So he says, in your patience, in your endurance, possess you your souls. And then he gives some direction to them about what's going to come as far as the temple goes. And he says, when you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. When Titus shows up with his army, understand, you don't have much time. Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let them which are in the midst of it depart out. And let not them that are in the countries enter thereinto. Anybody who's in the city, when you see that army show up, get out of town. And if you're out in the field and you see them start coming, don't go back in to get anything. You get out of there. And what history tells us is the Christians, when this happened 40 years later that were in Jerusalem, they had read this, they had heard this, they took it literally, and they got out of town. And the Christians were not wiped out in the siege of Jerusalem because they heard the scripture, the word of God, and they didn't say, that's probably an allegory. Or maybe it's a morality tale talking about good and ultimate evil. They said, looks like an army. You think we ought to leave? I think we ought to leave, honey. And they left, and they followed Jesus' word, and they were saved. Who'd have thought such a thing could happen? He says, for these be the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. And woe unto them that are nursing in that day, for there shall be great distress in the land and wrath upon his people. They shall fall by the edge of the sword and shall be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem shall be treaden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles shall be fulfilled. The days of vengeance. You remember what Jesus said, Matthew 23, he rides in, it's during this week. He says, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you that kill the prophets and stone them which are sent to you, how often I would have gathered you, your children together as a hen gathers her chickens under her wings, and you would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate, for I say unto you, you shall not see me henceforth till you shall see. Blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. Because you rejected me, this is all going to go away. And then in chapter 27 of Matthew, Jesus is standing before Pilate, and Pilate is trying to get out of having to crucify Jesus because he keeps saying, I find no fault in this man. And it says, when Pilate saw that he could prevail nothing, but rather a tumult was made, he took water and he washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. See you to it. I'm innocent of this. I don't want his blood on my hands. And then answered all the people and said, his blood be on us and our children. It's okay. We'll take it on ourselves. That's why they got Titus in 70 AD to come in and destroy the city and wipe out 1.1 million Jews and another 100 plus thousand got hauled off into slavery because they didn't receive the Messiah. Those are the days of vengeance. In Jerusalem will be trodden down of the Gentiles, and it's continued to be trodden down. The non-Jews under Rome, they wiped out the city. There was nothing there for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. It started to turn around a little bit in 1948 after World War II. The UN got together and gave a portion of Israel back to the Jews again. And suddenly a nation that hadn't existed for, as a nation anyways, for hundreds of years was back. 1967, they were attacked by their neighbors, and so they basically wiped them all out and took back Jerusalem. And now you have Jews back in Israel, back in Jerusalem. Of course, it's still not completely theirs. If you go there today to the Temple Mount where the temple used to stand, you see a building with a shiny golden dome on the top. It's called the Dome of the Rock. They don't have complete control of the area yet. He says, there'll be signs in the sun, the moon, the stars upon the earth, distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's heart failing them for fear. People will be freaking out so bad they'll be having heart attacks. And for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. In the very last days in Isaiah, it tells that the earth is going to be stumbling around like a drunk person, like a top that you've spun, you know, and it starts to slow down, and then you start to see that wobble happening. It's what's going to be going on in the earth, and people will be freaking out. And then he says in verse 27, they shall see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. They shall see it. Those who are around in those days will see the Lord returning with his church. But you, says in verse 28, when these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draws nigh. I believe that the Lord is going to come back, take his church out of here, and then that last 7-year period is going to be really bad, and then he'll return with his church to set up his kingdom. And he says this, a couple more verses. He spake unto them a parable, behold the fig tree and all the trees. When they now shoot forth, you see and know of your own selves that summer is nigh at hand. And so likewise, when you see these things come to pass, you know that the kingdom of God is near at hand. When you see the trees start to bud, you know spring is there, right? I mean, we're in Maine. What was it yesterday, like 45, 50 degrees out, right? The morning before it was 18 below at my house. It's like a 60-degree swing in a day. Welcome to Maine. But spring is near, right? When it's not 18 below for weeks on end, spring is coming. Well, when the plants start coming out, you see the leaves on the trees, you know spring. Well, when you see the fig tree begin to bud, and if you look, Hosea 9, Joel chapter 1, Israel is talked about as being the fig tree, and now we see them back in the land. It means time is short. And he says, you know, this generation, the generation that sees these signs, they'll not pass away till all be fulfilled. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. And then he says this, take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting, that means hungover, and drunkenness, and the cares of this life, so that the day shall come upon you unaware. For as a snare, it'll come on all of them that dwell on the face of the whole earth. You don't want to be so dumb and numb and drunk and not paying attention that this stuff just escapes your attention. Read the news. Look and see what time we're in. Look scripturally at how you see the shape of the world. Understand that God judges time morally, and then look at the moral condition of our planet. And understand that time is short. Don't get so caught up in the face of this earth, the things that are here and now that take our attention away, that you don't look at the big picture, that this is not our home. And then this is the final one. Watch you therefore and pray always, that you may be counted worthy to escape all the things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Now, there was certainly a local fulfillment to that. Watch, because when you see the army showing up, get out of town. But then there's a long-term one for you and I. Watch and be ready so that when he comes back for us, before the bad stuff happens, you will be accounted worthy to fly up out of here. Make sure your accounts are short. Make sure that you are in tune with what God has on his agenda. And pray always that we may be counted worthy to escape. Makes sense, doesn't it? Let's pray. Lord, we thank you that you give us warnings in advance. Father, that you show us time is short and that nothing needs to happen before your return. Lord, I don't know when you are coming back, but I pray it is soon. Lord, help us to be in tune with your heart. Lord, to be busy about your business and not our own. And Lord, please, before you return, one last time, Lord, turn the heart of this nation back to you. We have friends and we have relatives that we want to see get right with you before the hard stuff happens. We trust you. We ask you to come quickly. It's in your Son Jesus' name we ask it. Amen. Grace and peace, guys.